morning. He does love. It all begins there. He loves. He creates. He still loves. I want to start this morning by asking you a question. And for those of you in the room that hate this kind of thing, I'll just apologize, but I'm still going to do it. I'd like you to find someone around you that neither woke up in your home this morning nor rode in with you this morning, okay? And I want you to tell them who is someone who's impacted your life in a way that you now do something differently because of the impact that they had, okay? Coach, teacher, parent, I guess is, that's kind of, you know, the cop-out answer, that's fine. But like, who's someone that you came across that crossed paths with you and now you're different, like you do something different. If you can name that thing, what is it you do differently because of their impact, okay? Tell that other person, okay? I'm going to give you, that's like seriously, like 2 minutes, okay? 2 minutes, so turn and tell somebody who changed your life and how are you different because they changed your life, okay? Go. Yeah, I'm looking at you. Those of you who don't like to talk to people that you don't know, you might need to tell them your name. All right. The kindest words every introvert in the room is waiting to hear. That's enough. Okay. How many of you, someone said to you, someone told you something about someone in, like, that's vocationally driven, something in the workforce. I do something different in the workforce because of, okay, someone said that to you. Good. How many of you, it was like a coach? Maybe a coach somewhere. Okay, how many, just a friend? Like, I had this friend, or they told you, I had this friend who, how many of you was a teacher? Teachers? Oh, come on. All right. What we're talking about, we're starting a series today that we're calling Upside Down Kingdom. Okay? Upside Down Kingdom. And essentially what you were just asked to do was reflect on a time where you were discipled. Now, that's like a Bible word for it, but it actually comes from the same root as discipline, and it means that someone helped show you boundaries and keep you within those boundaries and move you in a certain direction, and you were discipled by someone. You became their student, whether it was formal or not, that the question didn't ask you for that, but we're asking this question here in this series. What does it mean to be a disciple in the kingdom of Jesus? Okay? What does it mean to be a disciple in the kingdom of Jesus? And I did have a teacher who changed my life. His name was Frank. Some of you in the room will remember Frank. We called him Frank because we weren't allowed to call him Professor Benyuski. Okay? He just wanted us to call him Frank. And that's one of the things, actually, that stood out to me. He was a professor that I had when I was in college. And one of the things that stood out about him was the affinity that he had to have meaningful relationships with us, his students. He didn't set up a gulf between us or a gap between us that we couldn't really know him, but rather he sat in the front of the room with us and had a conversation. We were regularly invited into his home. He was someone who had started an education system in the Indiana State Penitentiary. He cared deeply about people who were lost and hurting, and he used the resources that he had available to him to do something about their situation, their plight. He was interesting because he was a little bit controversial. I went to an evangelical liberal arts college that was pretty conservative, and Frank was not all that conservative. So he was always getting in trouble for certain things he was saying that he really did believe. But he always did it in a gracious way. He always did it in a way that quite frankly, when it was all said and done, the people who were angry at him came out looking worse for their anger. Right? And as someone who just, I thrive on being contrary, okay? That's not a good thing about me. But as someone who thrives on being contrary, I learned from Frank the importance of holding my beliefs in such a way that is hospitable to others, to discuss and to dialogue with me, to not hold people at a distance. But I learned to try to bring people in. I did not do that when I met Frank at all. I used what I believed to try and show people how smart I was, to try and show them that I could out-argue them. And Frank taught me to sit down, to listen, to hear what people have to say. He taught me to ask questions. Okay? He taught me to be hospitable with those, to those that I don't agree with. And I'm different because of Frank's influence on my life. Frank discipled me. Okay? And he, at times, it was very purposeful. Now, what we're looking at here is the question that we want to address, because there's this message throughout the Bible. Okay? This message throughout the Bible that God has moved towards us, and he's invited us to come with him, not just to recognize that he's present, but to actually go somewhere with him. Again, biblically, we call it being his disciple. But today, we're going to focus on this idea of being a follower of a king who's ruling a kingdom that seems like it's upside down. Because the things that Jesus says to us, the places that he invites us to go, these are places that oftentimes they seem so unfamiliar because they're so unnatural to us. And so for the next 6 weeks, we're going to spend time talking about this upside-down kingdom and what it means to be a disciple of a king who flips things upside down. All right? Now, if you got a Bible, would you turn to Luke chapter 6? Luke 6, we're going to be in the chapter of Luke for the next 6 weeks, and it's the sixth chapter of Luke, just in case, you know, you're home and what should I read? Okay? 6 weeks, Luke 6. And we're going to be checking out this story in Luke chapter 6, but it's a story that's paralleled also in the biblical book of Matthew, one of the other gospels. And just to give us some background on this, there's three stories of Jesus are called gospels, or stories about his life that are called gospels. Gospel just means a story of good news. So, but they're called synoptic gospels. The word synoptic means that they're seen together, the sin and the optics seen together. What that means is that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're in agreement on the basic structure of the story. Like, they kind of follow the same structure, sort of like Jesus' birth, his initiation to ministry, things that happen in and around Galilee, which was the northern region, and then towards about the last third of each of those gospels, Jesus moves south to Jerusalem, and that's he heads towards his crucifixion and ending with the resurrection. So that's sort of, they're synoptic gospels because they're arranged that way, but each of them is unique in its details because they were each written to a unique audience. Okay? They're written to a unique audience. And the story that we're going to look at, and it's not so much a story as it is Jesus' teaching, the teaching that we're going to look at in Luke chapter 6 is more famously actually in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. Okay, if you talk about the Sermon on the Mount, typically people think of Matthew 5, 6, and 7. I want to get through this. I don't want to bore you with it, but they're the same teaching, but there are differences. So I want to make sure that we understand what we're looking at. Actually, in Matthew, and we're using this title, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, it actually says Jesus was on the mount. In Luke chapter 6, we'll see he actually says he goes to a level place or a plain. Okay, so it kind of gives the setting a little bit differently. Obviously, three chapters in Matthew, it's longer. In Luke chapter 6, it's shorter. That's not just about the length. In Matthew 5, 6, and 7, there's more detail. The teaching is more detailed. Now, all that being said, if this is the longest sermon of Jesus that Jesus ever taught, you can read the whole thing in less than 15 minutes. Okay? No commentary on how long we should be here this morning. If Jesus can get it done in 15, I'm still going to need my 35. I'm sorry. All right? Although we started 5 minutes late, I was told that came out of my time. It's debatable, okay? But in Luke chapter 6, it's shorter, and it's shorter, but it's a little bit more direct, okay? A little bit more direct. It doesn't linger in certain areas quite as long. In Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7 is more focused on the law, the Old Testament law, the Jewish law, and how the message of Jesus was different from the Old Testament law. Repeatedly, he says, "You've heard it said," and he quotes the law, but then he says, "But I say to you," he's contrasting. In Luke chapter 6, there's more focus on the way. This is the way to think, the way to be. Okay, that's often attributed to the fact that the audience for the Gospel of Matthew is assumed to be a Jewish audience, thus the emphasis on the Jewish law. The audience for Luke is assumed to be a Greek audience, thus a focus on the way, or the way of life, which was a common thread in Greek thought. Okay, so Gentile Christians and non-Christians. But, okay, to sum it up, Both sermons are a synopsis. They're a summary of Jesus' teaching in and around Galilee, the northern region of Israel, at the outset of his public ministry. So this is sort of the beginning of his time out with the people, doing teaching and performing miracles and drawing disciples. They each contain portions of one or many longer sermons that would have been repeated regularly. The idea being, in all likelihood, that neither Matthew 5 through 7 nor Luke chapter 6 contain everything that Jesus taught in sequence on any one given day, but rather they were things that Jesus regularly would have taught as he moved around the region. And so each one of them contains teachings that his disciples would have heard over many times if they had followed him from place to place. And so you see there's going to be things that are the same in them, but in other places, in different teachings, he may have said other things. And Matthew chooses to include some that Luke does not. So that's just to set it up, Matthew 5 through 7 and Luke chapter 6. So here's what is in Luke chapter 6. There's five things that Jesus teaches on, five things. He gives a set of blessings and warnings. Beatitudes is how we normally hear them said, but blessings and warnings about life and our values, okay? He tells us about how to deal with difficult people or our enemies. He's going to teach about that. He talks about judging others. Okay, sort of that goes right along with our enemies, doesn't it? He talks about a fruitful life, sort of like what does it mean to be flourishing and have a fruitful life? And then he talks about a solid foundation. Where do we build our life? And those five stories are talked about here in Luke chapter 6, and they're talked about in a way that really can, if we take them at what they say, they're really going to pull the rug out from underneath us when it comes to what we believe to be true about life, what's been handed to us, what comes naturally to us. The way of Jesus as someone who wants us to be his followers, his disciples, is a way that's upside down. He's going to tell us things that seem so contrary to our gut. He's going to say, You may try to do this on your own, but that's not the right way to go about things. You may think that this is the value, these are the values you ought to have in life, but I'm going to tell you that those things, if you value them, you're actually completely backwards, and they're not blessings. They may actually be curses in your life. And that's why as we get into this, it's why we're calling this, it's an invitation into this upside-down kingdom. It's not about religion. In fact, just before the section we're going to look at, we're going to start in verse 12. But in the first 11 verses of Luke's gospel, which I already said is sort of facing those who were non-Jewish, the first 11 verses, Jesus gets into a little bit of a debate on the law of the Sabbath with the religious types in his day, the Pharisees and the scribes. And on one case, his followers, they take grain and they grind it in their hands, which was considered work in the Old Testament, the way they interpreted the Old Testament law. And so his followers were scorned for that. And Jesus says, oh, come on, I'm Lord of the Sabbath. If we're hungry, we're going to eat on the Sabbath. And the second story, he actually heals someone. It's fascinating. You should read this first 11 verses. He actually heals someone. And he does it in a public display where he knows the scribes and Pharisees are standing around waiting to trap him, right? And he brings this person to him and he says, reach out your arm. When he does, it's healed. And it's happened again on the Sabbath day. And this was considered, you weren't allowed to heal on the Sabbath day. But Jesus did. And he challenges them and he says, is it better to do good or better not to do good? Better to bring life on the Sabbath or let people die? Okay? And what he's getting at, what he's introducing us to, is that this is not what the kingdom that Jesus is about, is not an invitation into a religious system. Oh, there is a religious movement associated with him. It bears his name. But it's not an invitation to join a religious system. It's not an invitation to come into some boundaries that will keep life simple. It's rather an invitation into a life with him. Into a life with him. And that's where we're going to camp for the next 6 weeks. Okay? So are you in Luke chapter 6 if you've got a Bible? If not, here it is. Look at verse 12. I'm going to read a section of verses here, beginning in verse 12. It said, in these days, he being Jesus, went out to the mountain to pray. And all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12 whom he named apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew... Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew, his brother, and James, and John, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas, the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon, who came near to him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out of him and healed them. So we have this setup, and this is where we're going to camp today. We have this setup. This isn't the teaching yet, okay? In the next set of verses, we're going to get those five teachings on those five subjects. But today what we get is the setup. Who's he talking to, and what significance do they have? It may seem like it's just transition. It may seem like it's just a list of names, but there's some important ideas in here. There's some important ideas in here. And so in order to move through this, here's what I want to do. I want you to visualize a city. Can you do it? Anybody got a picture? All right. There's one. I think that's L.A. Anybody know? There's skyscrapers? Anyway, I think that's L.A. But what I want to do is I want to just to help us visualize, I want to locate Jesus somewhere. I think that's the U.S. Bank building in downtown L.A., I think. Okay? If it's not, you can correct me. Actually, don't bother. Okay. But I want to locate Jesus somewhere, okay? So Jesus is he's in a place. When we get to Luke chapter 6 here, he's found somewhere. And in that location, there's all kinds of things around him. Just like today, there's all kinds of things surrounding Jesus, but I want to draw some conclusions about where he's found based on, or not even make, draw some conclusions first. I want to make some observations. The first thing it tells us is that Jesus goes away to the mountain to spend time with his Father. Yeah, he goes away to spend time with his Father. Now, whole sermons can be taught on time alone and prayer and meditation on who Christ is. But the point we want to make here, okay? The point we want to make here is that Jesus, remember the context of this thing, it's at the beginning of his public ministry. He's about to go out and do something for God. But before he goes out, the first thing he does is he withdraws. There's this sort of rhythm to his life. He doesn't just go and go and go and go and go, but he stops. He withdraws, and he goes up to the mountain to pray. Now, the things that Luke tells us come next, we get more detail in some of those other synoptic gospels, but the things that come next is that he actually goes out and he selects co-laborers. He selects co-laborers. He selects people, he invites people to come walk with him. Okay? From amongst his disciples, it said, from all the people who already had chosen to sort of follow him, to be disciplined by him, to walk his way, he actually selects some more. And he selects some to come to be a little bit closer to him. We'll say more about them in a minute. But there's this pattern in the scriptures. This is actually Paul writing to the church in Philippi, and he says something that's carried on in what Jesus did. He says, what you've learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Do you see this pattern? What Jesus is going to do, Paul explains to us a little like directly here in Philippians. He says, when you're with me, you're going to learn things, receive things from me. You're going to see things in me. Go and do those things. So I go back to that question, who taught you to do what you do? Who taught me to do what I do? The good and the bad. I've seen things in people. I've received things from people. I've been taught things. And some of those things I've absorbed and adopted. And now I practice them. And you do too. So what Jesus is doing here is he's coming down off the mountain. He's inviting co-laborers. But the last thing is this, he initiates with the masses. Do you see this? I think that the geography of this is fascinating. And I think Luke does this on purpose. Remember the difference between Matthew and Luke? In Matthew, it's called the Sermon on the Mount, like he stood on the side of the mountain and spoke. And in Luke, it actually says he comes down from the mountain and stands in a level place. It's likely that we're talking, Luke and Matthew are referencing different periods of time in Jesus' ministry. Same message, different times. But Luke stands on a level place. He comes down off the mountain, and he initiates with the masses, with the people. This is fascinating, right? Because in our minds, oftentimes, we think that the mountaintop is the place to reside. Like, no, I felt God there. I need to stay there. I need to dwell in that place. But the picture that we get from Jesus is actually very different. And Jesus, instead of staying on the mountain, he comes down into this level place, and he's out with the masses. He goes to them. He initiates. Okay? He made himself available to the masses. And I think we understand this later on in Luke. Jesus is talking about himself, and he says, the Son of Man, that's code for him, Jesus, the Son of Man, came to seek and to save the lost. You see, what we find here about Jesus is that Jesus is not, he's not just sitting still and waiting. He's seeking. He's initiating. He has moved towards people. He's moved towards them because they're lost. And we'll see more about that in a minute here. We see another group. He calls these apostles. He calls these apostles. And so if you look there, Jesus is, you know, he's still in the U.S. Bank building. But he calls this group of people that we're going to put, like, right close to him, okay? They're sort of near him. They're the apostles. And we would say this about them, that they are the nearest to Jesus. And I put nearest in quotes on purpose, obviously. They're nearest to him, not necessarily meaning that they're holier than the rest of the disciples. But when it comes to proximity, if you looked at their life, particularly at this is the beginning of this period of time, for the next several years, these are the people that are going to be kind of on Jesus' hip. They're going to be right next to him. They're going to hear firsthand all the things that he says and that he does. The stuff that Paul writes about in Philippians, that the things you've seen me do and practice, or seen in me and receive from me, you practice those things. These are the people who had the clearest view. These are the people that we owe today for having told us who Jesus is, what he said, what he did, where he went. These are the people who witnessed to his resurrection. But there's also something that nearest has to be in quotes here, because that proximity to the activity of Jesus doesn't guarantee that you're actually following Jesus, right? Because did you catch what's in the list? Okay. In verse 16 of that passage, it says, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. Luke makes a point here in this list of saying something that the reader of this, if they had any knowledge of Jesus, already would have known. That one of these 12, though they were very close to Jesus for most of his ministry, they became a traitor. They were near him. Anyone on the outside who would have been looking would have said, yep, they're one of Jesus' guys. In fact, we know about Judas that he kept the money. He was trusted in that way. But when we say nearest, we don't necessarily mean that his heart was tuned to Jesus. We don't necessarily mean that proximity means that you are necessarily following in the way of Jesus. It's why this kingdom message is going to turn things upside down, because it's going to say you can do all the religious practices, you can learn all the lessons, you can be present for all the stuff, but not really catch it in your heart. There can be something missing. Okay? So let's keep looking. Sorry, those apostles were selected from among the disciples. And that goes on. Ephesians, it tells us he, being the God and his Spirit, gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and teachers to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ. God draws people out for a specific purpose and to perform a specific function. And that happens. Okay? That happens. And we talk around here a lot about how has God drawn you out? How has he called you? How has he gifted you to equip the saints? But keep looking, because there's another group of people that are mentioned, and they're a D on the map because they're disciples. There's this group of disciples. This is a great crowd of them, so there must have been a lot at this point in time. There's this great crowd of disciples. And we're trying to do something with proximity here, see? The apostles were sort of nearest, but there are these other people that are out there as well. And with the disciples, here's what's true about them, right? We already know that they are listening to and following Jesus. He's come out off the mountain, and they're there. He engages with them. They're already listening to him. They're already following him at some level, okay? So they're beyond curiosity. They've moved beyond curiosity into a realm of what we might say is obedience. He said, follow me, and they've done it, okay? They're out with him. It's beyond just curiosity. Jesus says this in John chapter 8, another gospel, but not one of these synoptics, but Jesus says, he said to the Jews who believed in him, if you abide in my word, if you sort of dwell in my teaching, in my truth, you are truly my disciples. So this word disciple has a little bit more than just like, yeah, I like what Jesus has to say, right? I'm curious about what Jesus might be saying. It's more than saying like you know, Jesus has a lot of good wisdom. A disciple is someone who, as John says here, abides or dwells or lives in the truth of Jesus, in his word. They've bounded themselves in by it. It defines good and bad and right and wrong for them. And so the disciples are beyond curiosity and they move to obedience. But here's the thing about these disciples, they are largely anonymous. They're largely anonymous. They're not named. I think that's intentional in the passage. From amongst the disciples, some are called in. Okay? Some are called in to be apostles. But by and large, the disciples of Jesus are anonymous. They're just folks. Okay? They're just folks. They're folks who were probably, as we'll even see with the masses, who were just kind of part of the crowd at one point. They were just sort of people of the land, like people who lived and dwelled and went day to day about their business. But they had taken steps to be with Jesus, to follow him. Okay? These are the disciples. These are his disciples. And then last, there's this really large group, right? They're kind of spilling off the image, right? It's good. But these are the crowds. This crowd comes out, okay? This crowd comes out. And as I use this phrase once, but these are what would be called the people of the land. These are the hoi polloi. Like, these are the people that just kind of, like, they just live and do their thing and no one, like, is really any wiser to it. These are people who may feel like they're cogs in a wheel, right? These are people who may just feel like they kind of, you know, go about day to day and no one really notices. The people of the land, the crowd. But the crowd had come out to see Jesus and they were coming from unexpected places. We can't do this without one of these, okay? No matter whether this the teaching that Luke is referencing, no matter how close it is up there to that center Galilee area where it's in purple, it's happening somewhere around there. But Luke makes specific mention of a couple places. And I don't think that this is by accident. I actually am crazy enough to believe that all scripture is profitable for teaching. It actually mentions that they came from Jerusalem and Judea. Okay? Now, that's the bottom section down there near the Dead Sea. Jerusalem is the big city for the Jews. So there are people who have, in Luke's telling, have moved from the south to the north to hear Jesus teach. Okay? They've come from the big city out to the Midwest of Israel to hear Jesus teach. And it mentions Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon. This is interesting as well because Tyre and Sidon on the spectrum of places were the exact opposite of Jerusalem in the eyes of the reader. Jerusalem was a religious capital for the Jews. Tyre and Sidon, those were like religious enemies. Those were people who had bowed to worship idols. These were people that were, for all intents and purposes, they were just unwashed heathens and they didn't belong with the Jews. But what we find here, what we find is being said by Luke, he's emphasizing a point in the places that he mentions. And he says, Jesus is teaching in such a way that people from both ends of the spectrum are coming together to hear what he's telling them. People who consider themselves to be, would come from a direction that is righteous. People that would be coming from a place where they think they've got it all together, that they've got all the answers. And people who, quite frankly, have no interest in the religious system of the Jews, people that would be on the opposite end of the spectrum who would say, I live how I live. I do what I do. But what's happening is that there's a convergence point, and we've got Galilee on the map, but the real point of convergence is in Jesus, right? He's the thing that's brought them out. He's the one that's got their attention. And I think it's because of this. They were coming out because they had very real needs that were met by him. Very real needs that were met by him. Look at what it says again here in Luke chapter 6. And I am skipping a few spots here, but you can read it in all of it. But it says, a great multitude from those places came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out of him and healed them all. Did you catch this? So here's Jesus. He's come down and initiated with the people. And the crowds are coming out because when they get nearer to him, their very real problems are healed. There's a curiosity about this guy. There's some level of interest. He's got something that they need. And his power is solving their problems. They're not included in Luke's telling. They're not included in that ring of disciples. See the proximity? They're not as close to Jesus as some, but they are there. They're there. And they're there because he is meeting their needs. But what Luke is doing, he's actually, if you watch, he's describing these people who are drawing closer to Jesus. They're moving towards him. These apostles started in that group of D's, right? And he draws them closer and says, you need to take another step. You need to come nearer to me. Those disciples at one point in time were in the C's. They were in the crowd. But they have responded to his offer, at least at the level of following him, going out to meet him and to hear his teaching. And the crowd has moved from completely off the map to being in the same place as Jesus, to associating themselves in some way. So our question today, to wrap up with this, our question today, are you an A, a D, or a C? Is that fair to ask? If you were to stake, like put a pin down on the map in proximity to Jesus, where do you believe that you are? Are you certain that God has called you out? He's gifted you so that you can fulfill a purpose? Are you sitting in a place where you would say, like, I've moved beyond curiosity. I've listened to Jesus. I've trusted his teaching in ways that are real in my life. I'm a D. And you may be here this morning as a C. I'm interested in Jesus, but I don't know. I've got needs. I'm not sure that my needs are met. But I'm here. I'm curious. I want to know what Jesus has to say. Where would you identify? Which of those would you say most closely matches your life now? Because if you're an A, you're an apostle, the question is, how can I be used for his kingdom? I'm near to him. I've said yes, and I know that he has put me in a particular place. How can I be used? And Jesus is going to say, as he says with these apostles, I need all of your life. And I don't know how else to sugarcoat this. There is no way to sugarcoat this. That's probably going to mean suffering. The nearer we get to Jesus, see, this is, notice the trend here. On the edges, they're described as people whose immediate needs are met. The disciples are a bit anonymous, but the closer you get, the stories of these apostles, these are stories of people who gave everything they had to Jesus, everything. They gave up everything about their way of life to follow him. Even after his death, burial, and resurrection. And the end of their story wasn't mansions on this earth. It wasn't an easy time of it. It wasn't a smooth path. The answer to their story was that they actually, the closer you get to him, the more you share in his suffering. The way of Jesus, A is in the room, is a way where we lay down our life. As Jesus said in Luke 11, the wisdom of God says, I will send prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill and persecute. The path of the apostle is one that is going to be, if you think you might be an A, or you think you might want to be an A, be careful what you ask for. We're invited into a life. Now, it's the right life. It's the life where true life, abundant life, is found. But the path is not one that's easy. It's a path where we come and die. If you're a D in the room, sorry, it may be hard to see, but it says, what else do I have to give? I think the disciples are there, and they're saying, I'm following you. I've obeyed you, but what else is left? And this is where we're going to spend the heart of the next 5 weeks. But comfort, control, priorities come back as the answer. Your values, if we're a disciple of Jesus, our values have to be in question. We're not really a disciple of Jesus if we don't value the things that he says are valuable. We're not moving towards him if we are continually taking control of our life rather than handing it to him more and more. We're not really his disciple if we keep retreating from him and retreating from his people and his body because it gets uncomfortable. He's going to address those things. Hang in with us. That's what's coming. And if you came in and said, like, can my problems be fixed? I'm a C. I'm just curious. I'm in the crowd. I don't know. Can my problems be fixed? I'm hurting. I have needs. And I don't, like, my needs are not being met. Where do I go? I think I might need to go somewhere where this Jesus guy is talking. And here's the thing. He hears you. He's going to come down. When he comes down off the mountain and he speaks, but he's going to say some difficult things. He's going to say, your way of life is wrong. He's saying that to all of us. It doesn't matter which piece we're in, which if we're an A, a D, or a C, an apostle, a disciple, or if we're just in the crowd at this point. He's saying there are things in your life that have to change. They're contrary to my kingdom. Later on in Luke, he's going to say this. If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. Take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. The more we try to hang on to it, the more we try to take control, the more we try to keep our kingdom facing the way that seems natural to us, the less willing we are to let Jesus disrupt our lives. Jesus is saying that pattern doesn't end in life. That pattern ends up losing life. And so the invitation is, no matter where you are, no matter what is your starting point, Jesus has initiated a new way of life for us. It doesn't matter how close I may feel to him in proximity. It's possible that just like Judas, I'm saying no to him in my heart. That is a real possibility. No matter what is the starting point, Jesus is initiating this new way of life. He has moved towards you. He has come down to be with us. And his resurrection and ascension, he says, but I am with you always. He's here. He's not distant from us. He's here. He still speaks. He's here and he's healing us. But he's also calling us nearer. Come closer. Come closer. Will you pray with me? God, we're we're thankful that you have spoken, but I just confess that I don't always know, I don't always understand, I'm not always sure, and I doubt. I don't doubt that you're real, but I doubt that you're moving in good ways. I doubt that you're, that you really are taking me to places that are better, that you're moving me, that this path that you have that often doesn't feel good, that leads through suffering, that in the end that it's what's best. But God, I want to believe. I want to believe. I want to believe that everything you've said is true. That though we may suffer, that you give us life. We have hope in you. We find peace in you. That we're satisfied with you. God, we're tired of chasing other stories. I'm tired of believing lies. I do want to be near you. And I ask that you would give me the faith, that you would give me more than I have so that I can draw near to you, that my doubts can become certainty. So God, we're just, we give this to you. We confess that we do not know the way. We need you to show us. We need to walk with you. So God, please show us where to go. And we pray all this, Jesus, in your name. Amen.